And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, there's a public forum about the Superfund cleanup tomorrow night.
U.S. senators turned down four gun-related measures this afternoon.
And Strike Debt Portland plans a major event tomorrow night for the debt resistors to fight back.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 20th, 2016. I'm Natasha Delapine.
And I'm Theo Burke. A public forum to discuss the proposed cleanup plan for the Portland Harbor Superfund site is scheduled for tomorrow evening, Tuesday, June 21st, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the former Harriet Tubman School, located at 2231 North Flint Street in Portland. A presentation of the cleanup plan will be followed by a public question and answer session. The EPA's newly released $750 million cleanup plan calls for dredging and capping with cement the most contaminated areas of the river and adjoining riverbanks. The main tenet of the proposed plan calls for most of the river to be allowed to recover naturally over a period of 30 years. A public comment period is now open and runs until August 8th. In addition, a second EPA public meeting on the proposed cleanup plan is also scheduled for this Friday, June 24th, from 11:30 a.m. to 8 p.m. at the Portland Building, located at 1120 Southwest 5th Avenue. Three additional public presentations are scheduled as well. The public is invited to attend and comment in person. Comments are also accepted via email at harborcomments@epa.gov.
On Saturday, 21 people were arrested for blocking the Burlington Northern Railroad tracks in Vancouver, Washington, in protest of the oil train derailment, spill, and fire that occurred in Mosier earlier this month. More than 100 protesters gathered Saturday morning in Vancouver and formed a human chain across the railroad tracks for several hours before being arrested by the Vancouver Police Department. Among the protesters who spoke at the demonstration was current chief of the Mosier Fire Department, Jim Appleton. A former supervisor of oil trains, Appleton has become a fierce critic of shipping oil by rail. Appleton said, quote, "The Mosier derailment proves those trains are just too dangerous." Initial court proceedings for the protesters were scheduled to begin today.
Strike Debt is a decentralized network of debt resistors, including activists, artists, and organizers, which grew out of the Occupy Wall Street movement in 2012. Strike Debt Portland is collaborating with the Debt Collective, hosting debtors' assemblies, protests, speakers, and other events in the Portland area. They want to connect with debtors who are interested in debt strikes, so they're holding an event on Tuesday at Cathedral Park. KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with local organizer Daniel Hong to find out more.
Daniel, tell us about Strike Debt.
Yeah, so Strike Debt is a national movement founded in 2012 through activists at Occupy Wall Street. They are a movement around debt education, about kind of a critical analysis of how debt operates in our society and how it contributes to inequality, and as well as resistance, as in people who are indebted to know their rights, both as individuals and to organize in collectives to negotiate with their creditors. And Strike Debt Portland was founded in 2013 as a branch of Strike Debt. And Strike Debt has since evolved into the Debt Collective, which is organizing debtors into collectives.
Let's see. And so how does the Debt Collective work exactly?
Yeah, so the Debt Collective works initially with a website, debtcollective.org, that people can sign up for and create accounts for. And they are actually going to revamp their website, so it is more of a social media network, so that different profiles can talk to each other. Their main campaign has been with students of for-profit colleges, so Everest, ITT Tech, Art Institutes, University of Phoenix, DeVry, these colleges that make money off of the backs of students, off of student loans, and are riddled with financial fraud and poor quality education. And the Debt Collective announced a big strike in 2015, where 15 former students of Everest College publicly said that they're not paying back their loans. A lot of these students who were already in default or who are in deferment or who had their loan statuses be unknown couldn't pay back their debts anyway, but effectively saying we have a economic and moral obligation not to pay back our loans for a school that defrauded us. And that has reached up to the ceiling of the Department of Education, and the Debt Collective has effectively created an appeal process for for-profit students to dispute their loans and to share their stories. And that has actually resulted in students having their loans discharged. So with the Debt Collective, with their new website, and in coming years, they hope to organize medical debtors, payday loan debtors, and other forms of debt.
Great. Now, the Strike Debt Portland, you have an event coming up this week. In fact, it's tomorrow, right? What do you have going on?
Yeah, so we are having a community potluck and discussion forum. We call it a debtors assembly, and it is where we assemble and share food and talk about debt, talk about what it is, how it affects us. We have people share personal testimonies. We lead a facilitated discussion about an educational discussion on how debt is created and how debt works and how debt is tied to economic injustice and is a form of economic injustice. And because people are being forced to put themselves liable for their basic needs, you know, going into debt for housing, going in debt for education to get education to get a better life, and as well as medicine, like things that are things that should be public goods, that be human rights, and should be funded for all. Instead, people have to go into debt and go into default for it, and that's not okay. So we also hope to kind of provide resources and next steps for people who want to learn more about their debt.
Well, indeed. And regarding next steps moving forward, what do you hope that Strike Debt Portland can do?
Yeah, we want to support the Debt Collective. They are announcing a new, their next phase of their strike in the fall for all for-profit college students and their kind of and other student debtors in solidarity, and we want to support the Debt Collective. We also want to actually partner with other groups with Portland Tenants United and with environmental groups and host educational forums about how debt intersects with these issues, because they do. And just to clarify, the assembly is happening tomorrow around 4 p.m. At Cathedral Park under St. John's Bridge.
Terrific. And where can people find out more details about the event, any future events you have going?
Yeah, so if you're on Facebook, we have a Facebook group page. It's titled Strike Debt Portland. We can also email us at strikedebtpdx@riseup.net, RISEUP.net. Also, we have access to the National Strike Debt Calendar. So if you want to find out more about the national movement, go to strikedebt.org and debtcollective.org.
Terrific. Daniel, any closing thoughts for our listeners?
Yeah, you are not alone. That you are worth more than the government's disregard for public goods. And we hope to see you there.
Terrific. I've been speaking with Daniel Hong of Strike Debt Portland. They have an event, a debtors assembly, at 4 p.m. at Cathedral Park. Daniel, I wish you all the luck in the world. Thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
Today we have Emma Colbrun, who loves maps, for an interview. She is one of a growing number of people who see them as more than just a way to get somewhere. Her project, the Williams Avenue Map Circles, is about history, architecture, and communities. She is with us here tonight live. Thank you for coming in, Emma.
Thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to be here with you.
Thank you. Well, first, explain what the Williams Avenue Map Circles as a project is.
Yeah, so actually it's a project with several different phases. The first phase was a series of walking workshops that we did this past spring. So let me back up, the Map Circle is coming out of an artist residency that I have at Poa Cafe, which is on Williams and Shaver. So I'm there as the artist in residence for this year, 2016, and I wanted to create a project that would kind of explore the identity of the neighborhood as it stands, but also kind of the shoulders that it stands on as well. And so I created this project with several different phases and called it the Williams Avenue Map Circles. So the first phase was a series of walking workshops where we looked for different eras of investment into the architecture of the neighborhood. So looking for houses that were built in the Victorian era, houses like American craftsman style houses, and then going all the way up through the 60s. And with each era, each week was a different era. And as we were looking for the different elements of the architectural styles that represent that era, we were also talking about kind of historic moments that were indicative of that era and basically kind of decoding the landscape or reading it as if the buildings were signs that told a language about the story that it came from. So that was the first part of the project. Then I worked with a group of artists at Project Grow, which is on the corner of basically Tillamook and Williams. And we created a collaboratively woven map of the space between Project Grow and Poa Cafe. So it's about 15 blocks. We used pieces of scrap wood to build the main street, Williams, and then each of the intersecting streets. And then we took yarn, fabric, different kind of soft materials to weave into that wooden map to basically create a framework and a structure where each artist could kind of have a personal add their personal aesthetic to the main collaborative document, but also create something that speaks of the space between us. And so then the next phase is the phase that I'm here to talk a little bit about today, which is over the summer, there's going to be an ongoing urban history scavenger hunt. So the map now is being woven with places that indicate where formerly black-owned businesses were on the street. And so people have a chance to come to Poa Cafe, where the map will be installed, and select an address and then go out into the community and take a picture of what that address looks like now and then upload it to an online map that collects those images. So kind of the project in general is a way to negotiate kind of where we are now, both like physically as well as socially, with the past and also with looking into the future, and by creating experiences between people. Kind of, you and I were talking a little bit about the somatic elements of art making and how an experience can an embodiment, like an embodied experience, is different than a traditional like two-dimensional map experience. So that's kind of where my work is like how to create experiences where people can rethink the ways that they usually experience space.
And would you describe it, this experience, the second phase into the third, as like a somatic walking meditation, or more as a guided tour with the tendency to point the gentrification as well as other social aspects in the community that you're working in?
I think it's both. Actually, that's a really good question. That's part of why I wanted to activate the map by having a kind of participatory element with the addresses. I want people to be able to have a meditative experience walking through the neighborhood and going out on their own or with a friend, walking from the cafe to this other address, taking a picture and walking back, and maybe having the chance to meditate on the things that they're passing by and just kind of thinking about the space that they're passing through and how they're performing themselves, or how they're performing that space as well as they walk through it. And then, of course, there is an element of wanting to share a history that you don't necessarily see when you walk down the street today.
It sounds like these are mostly interactive as far as your sculptures and your, you know, two-dimensional, I suppose, maps go. What do you find different about the maps you have now versus the maps you started working with earlier?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I, as many of us, was like raised with the kind of Rand McNally, these very typical Mercator projection types of maps that are two-dimensional and oftentimes put the United States or Europe in like center of the map and enlarge the space. And basically those are what I started to learn as I started to study maps more and just started to travel myself more, is that those are very specific types of projections, and there's actually lots of different types of projections that are a projection, meaning a way to negotiate the three-dimensional space into two dimensions of a paper map. And so we grow up maybe looking at one type of map, but that's just one artist or one map maker's version of that space. And so that my project started, not this, well, this project, but also 7 years ago when I started working more with mapping and creating participatory mapping experiences. They were kind of to activate the perspective of the map maker. So whoever I was working with, wanting to kind of create a platform for other people to show their stories of space. So one project was called City Stitch, and I had sewers embroider their version of the city and then showed those collectively as one body of work. And although we were still using a standard like north is up, south is down kind of projection, it was still my first attempt at kind of showing how a multiplicity of perspectives exist within one geography. And that's kind of what the Williams Avenue map circles are getting at as well.
Could you give us an idea of how the varying sizes of these objects and places you can be in as far as physically walking in them, but also interacting with your hands in them as far as weaving in the earlier phase that you described with the map on Williams?
Yeah, so I see the map that's going to be displayed at POA over the summer as not only the map on the wall, which is about 6 feet of this kind of wooden, this very kind of ethereal negotiation between the firm structure of the wooden streets and then the more narrative or lyrical songs that this thread weaves. I see that as not only being the map on the wall, but also as being the space between those places, and that it is a document on the wall, but it also exists in the reality of the streets and the cars that are beeping and going by and the buses and the bikes and the strollers and everything that's going on the street during these next 2 months is also part of that map. And that's why I'm installing it through what I'm calling a walking installation. So we will walk the map this Thursday from Project Grow to POA Cafe. And that's kind of a gesture at what I'm talking about, and a way to kind of play with that, a way to play with how do you convert three dimensions into a contained space.
How could KBOO listeners become involved, view, or interact with your sculptures of art and versus a map, but also art? How do they do that? Do they come to your site at the Grow Cafe? What time, what day?
Yeah, definitely. So I'd love to invite everybody to come out this Saturday, June 25th from 3 to 5 p.m. to POA Cafe, which is at 4025 North Williams Avenue. We're going to be having an opening party, and the scavenger hunt will be activated during that time. So you can come out to POA Cafe to experience the installation of the map and perhaps even choose an address and go have a walk of your own. And then it will also be on display the whole month of July and August. So if you can't, for some reason, make it out this Saturday, I'd also love to invite you to take a look at the map and visit the cafe at another time that's convenient to you. And on the wall, there will be instructions on how to log in to see the map that we create collectively online. So that those instructions will all be at the cafe when you arrive.
What do you interpret as urban geography, and how does it affect your work?
Yeah, so urban geography is kind of the subsection of geography that has to do with cities and specifically of movements of people in those cities. So I'm actually working with an urban geographer, Dirk Kinsey, who has done a lot of archival research to look into the urban history of Williams Avenue. He created a map. The name that he used is escaping me right now, but it was a negotiation of a map that actually had been printed a couple years ago called the Williams Avenue Ghost Map, and that was a map to capture what the street looked like in 1958 before a lot of the Emmanuel Hospital developments happened. So he did some more research into that project, and that's where the addresses are coming from of these formerly black-owned businesses along the street. So urban geography is kind of, my work sits at the intersection of urban geography and kind of social or documentary art. And there's a whole budding field that's kind of at this, of geo-humanities, they call it, that's at this intersection of geography and the digital or soft humanities.
How has Williams Avenue changed in your view from the 1950s and sum it up for me, because we have about 20 seconds, probably more, to explain that, but I would love to hear more about how to see it too.
Definitely. Yeah, there's been so many changes, and I think one of the big things actually is looking into the future and being able to see that a lot of the changes and developments are happening now are based on a plan that is looking 20 years into the future. And so it's about looking towards the past, but also about choosing what kind of relationships we want to have with people on the street today. And one of the ways, important ways to do that, I think, is by looking into the past and knowing where we come from in order to be able to move forward.
Thank you, Emma. It's so nice to have you in studio with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Emma Kolbrunn, and she has a beautiful display on Williams Avenue. And on the 25th, this Saturday, you can come and see the movement of her collective art piece.
Find you an exit. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Harris Zafar of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community about a recent special interfaith prayer service. This will be followed at 6 by Labor Radio, Of the Working Class, By the Working Class, and For the Working Class. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, patchy drizzle after 11 p.m., mostly cloudy with a low around 58. Tomorrow, patchy drizzle before 11 a.m., cloudy through mid-morning, then gradual clearing with a high near 74. Today in history, in 1943, the city of Detroit erupted in a race riot. Within a few days, 25 black residents and 9 white residents had been killed. Of the 25 African Americans, 17 had been killed by white policemen. The quote of the day is from Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who said, "We must not pretend that the countless people who are routinely targeted by police are, quote, isolated, unquote. They are the canaries in the coal mine whose deaths, civil and literal, warn us that no one can breathe in this atmosphere. They are the ones who recognize that unlawful police stops corrode all our civil liberties and threaten all our lives. Until their voices matter, too, our justice system will continue to be anything but."
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Union workers laid off by Nabisco's parent company are urging a boycott of Nabisco products. Nabisco decided to wipe out 600 good American jobs in Chicago to make Oreos and other products in Mexico. So far, 294 workers have been laid off in two waves.
BCTGM Local 364 members were in Portland, Oregon, June 16th and 17th, picketing an Nabisco plant. Ron Baker is the union's strategic coordinator.
These companies move across borders and across oceans. They may make their products in other places, but there's one thing that they always come back to, and that's the root financial structure of the United States and its consumer base. If we can't be part of the production of products, then we should not be part of consuming them and financially rewarding these companies for actually dismantling the middle class in America.
Thousands of nurses began a strike in Minnesota, California, and Massachusetts Sunday. Minnesota Nurses Association RN Angela Bichetti says that a demand that nurses give up their health insurance for a lower quality plan is the biggest issue for her members.
What we currently have is a union-backed Minnesota Nurses Association plan that we've given up, you know, wages in the past for. It's part of our benefit package. And what Alina's asking us to do is go to higher deductible, higher out-of-pocket plans.
This is Mitch Lawrence of the Sports Minute for Workers Independent News. We already have our first major story out of the Olympics, and the flame has not even been lit. For the first time ever, a nation has been barred from competing in the popular track and field competition in the Summer Olympics because of cheating. Russia, a world powerhouse, was noted that it can't send its runners to Rio in August. Now, if you know anything about Vladimir Putin, you'll know that Putin is not going to be happy with the news. The reason for the barring of the Russian team is simple. It's been accused by the World Anti-Doping Agency of widespread doping. That's not all. The agency also alleges that there was a mass cover-up to mask the illegal drug use, and it was state-sponsored by the Russian government. Well, this is a first. In the past, nations have been barred for only political reasons. South Africa, for instance, was prohibited from competing in the Olympics from 1964 to 1988 because of its racist apartheid laws. This is the first time a nation is paying the price for cheating. It's too bad for the Russian athletes, especially the ones who don't cheat, but they had more than an inkling that this ban was coming. Since January, they have been suspended from all Olympic competition. If it's any consolation to the Russians, at least they won't have to worry about contracting the Zika virus. This is Mitch Lawrence.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers power professional is online at ibew.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Portland Commissioner Amanda Fritz has proposed a tax of 3% on the sale of recreational marijuana. If passed by the City Council, it will be placed in front of the voters on the November general election ballot. Commissioner Fritz has proposed the tax revenues to be used for drug and alcohol treatment and other programs, as well as support for neighborhood small businesses. The business support would be targeted primarily at women and minority-owned businesses. In addition, a portion of the funds would go to Portlanders whose past record of marijuana possession prior to legalization has hampered their professional and financial mobility. The proposed tax could generate $3 million for the programs. The current state of Oregon sales tax on recreational marijuana is 25%, but it is scheduled to drop to 17% in 2017. Commissioner Fritz noted that even if voters pass the 3% tax, the total tax on cannabis will still drop by 5% overall to 20% on January 1st of 2017. This is significantly lower than Washington's tax of 37% and Colorado's tax of 27.9%.
According to a new Iowa State University study, stigma is a major barrier that prevents people with mental illness from getting help. The study says that 1 in 5 Americans struggle with mental illness, including 137,000 Oregonians. KBOO reporter Ray Bodwell, in conjunction with the Oregon News Service, has more.
Hey folks, it's Deanna the Web Nerd here. Over the weekend, the Texas Democratic
At least 6 people are dead and more than 100 are wounded following an intense day of clashes Sunday in the town of Nochislan, a hub in Oaxaca's Mixtec region. Protesters have
An estimated 137,000 Oregonians have mental health needs, but stigma could be keeping them from seeking help. New research measured how 370 college students responded when given the opportunity to learn more online about mental health services. Daniel Lannan, the study's lead author at the University of Iowa, says even in a private and anonymous setting, someone with greater self-stigma is less likely to take the first step, getting information about help that is available.
Stigma means that a person is putting labels on themselves, like I'm weak, I'm disturbed, because they're believing what some parts of society are telling them about having a mental health concern or seeking counseling.
Lannan says many people still feel uncomfortable or threatened by mental illness, and these views often lead to discrimination or exclusion in social or work settings. He says as a result, people who need help have a harder time admitting there's a problem. Lannan says the study illustrates the need for better interventions, but adds that it can be tricky because efforts are often rejected. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 3/4 of all chronic conditions begin by the age of 24. Lannan says for many young people, it's a time of transition, going to college, working full-time, and moving away from home, adding to the reasons they may not seek help. He notes that by the time someone shows symptoms of distress, they're often struggling to function.
Functionally, in areas of their life, they're being impaired. They might miss work, they might miss class. In some cases, they might struggle with even hygiene, or they might strongly contemplate suicide.
1 in 5 people struggles with mental illness in the U.S., Lannan says, and those who look for help wait 11 years on average before finally getting treatment. He says the solution for removing stigma as a barrier needs to be addressed, both at a societal and individual level, for people to feel more comfortable taking those first steps to get better. For KBOO and the Oregon News Service, this is Ray Bodwell.
The Supreme Court today issued a ruling allowing the evidence of a drug crime that was discovered during an illegal search to be used at trial. The court ruled 5-3 in the case of Utah versus Streif. Defendant Streif was illegally detained and questioned by a police officer after he left a house where the officer suspected that some kind of drug-related activity was taking place. The officer ran Streif's license and learned he had had an outstanding traffic warrant. Then the officer placed him under arrest and performed a search, which turned up a small amount of methamphetamine. In the majority decision written by Justice Clarence Thomas, the court ruled that discovery of the arrest warrant weakened the connection between the unlawful stop and the evidence seized. Justice Sonia Sotomayor disagreed and issued a scathing dissent, writing, quote, "Do not be soothed by the opinion's technical language. This case allows the police to stop you on the street, demand your identification, and check it for outstanding traffic warrants, even if you are doing nothing wrong. If the officer discovers a warrant for a fine you forgot to pay, courts will now excuse his illegal stop and will admit into evidence anything he happens to find by searching you after arresting you on the warrant."
The presidential campaign of Donald Trump today announced former manager Corey Lewandowski is no longer on his staff. Trump has supported Lewandowski last March when he was accused of assault after grabbing the arm of a Wall Street Journal reporter. Lewandowski has had a history of hostile relationships with both members of the press and the Republican National Committee. According to the New York Times, this is seen by some as a move to add more national campaign experience as the Trump camp heads into the race for the general election in November. So far, no replacement has been announced.
After a 15-hour filibuster by Democrats last week, the U.S. Senate today rejected 4 different gun control measures. The proposals, 2 Democratic and 2 Republican, were voted on earlier this afternoon. They had been offered as amendments to the Commerce, Justice, and Science Appropriation Act. California Senator Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat, introduced an amendment to deny a gun sale if there was a reasonable belief that the buyer was likely to engage in terrorism. Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, another Democrat, proposed an amendment to close out the gun show loophole, requiring every gun purchaser to undergo a background check. Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican of Iowa, proposed an amendment to make it more difficult to add mentally ill people to the background database. Senator John Cornyn, Republican of Texas, proposed an alternative which would have required law enforcement notification when someone on the terror watch list attempted to buy a gun. The Appropriations Bill, H.R. 2578, was sent back to committee. The Senate is expected to consider it again in 2 weeks.
Social tensions reign in the southern Mexican state of Oaxaca after federal police used the deadly force against a protest in support of the state's teacher union. Shannon Young, with Free Speech Radio News, has more from Oaxaca City.
At least six people are dead and more than 100 are wounded following an intense day of clashes Sunday in the town of Nochislan, a hub in Oaxaca's Mixtec region. Protesters had been blocking a highway there and in other parts of the state for several days in support of the local teachers' union. The teachers have been calling for dialogue with federal officials since mid-May, thus far without success. In the meantime, federal authorities have arrested the union's top leadership. Sunday's police action was reportedly intended to clear ongoing highway blockades, but escalated to include deadly force. At first, officials denied the police were armed. When photographs from national and international media emerged showing otherwise, officials dismissed them as fakes and not from the action at Nochislan. But by the time the Monday morning news cycle rolled around, Mexico's federal police chief said the officers were responding to an ambush. All of the dead were protesters or supporters. Authorities say half of the more than 100 wounded are police. Not much information has been made public about people reportedly arrested in Nochislan Sunday. When news of the highway confrontation in Nochislan reached Oaxaca City, located about an hour and a half south, the State University radio station opened its phone lines to callers. After several hours, people identifying themselves as university students took over the broadcast facilities, much like what happened at the start of massive teacher-led protests in Oaxaca 10 years ago.
A toda la comunidad oaxaqueña que tenga la posibilidad de brindar apoyo en las barricadas.
As the day wore on and police approached, those in the radio station's studio put out public calls for support at barricades inside the city limits and reinforcements at the protest encampment in the state capital's main square. The unifying theme among dissident teachers in the states of Oaxaca, Chiapas, Guerrero, and Michoacán has been their opposition to a set of reforms that allows the federal government to weaken the power of their unions. These union chapters have long-standing socio-political ties to activist movements in their respective states, and the crackdown on the labor group is likely to reverberate across their larger network of allied organizations. For now, the mood in Oaxaca is tense, with many residents watching from the sidelines, hoping for a just de-escalation. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca City.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees released a report today showing that the global refugee crisis has grown significantly worse. An unprecedented 65 million people were displaced as of the end of 2015, compared with just over 59 million people 1 year earlier. The total includes more than 21 million refugees who have fled to other nations and another 40 million people who were internally displaced, that is, they were forced to flee their homes but were still within their own countries. The refugee agency estimates that around the world, 24 people per minute are forcibly displaced every single day. Measured against the Earth's population, this means that one in every 113 people globally is now either an asylum seeker, internally displaced, or a refugee. The three countries accounting for the largest numbers of refugees are Syria, Afghanistan, and Somalia. The three nations with the largest number of internally displaced people are Colombia, Syria, and Iraq. The UN Refugee Agency also reported that 51% of the world's refugees in 2015 were children.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell, Natasha Delapin, and Al Khan. Special thanks to Oregon News Service. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving, and a special thanks to the Oregon News Service. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, and 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Natasha Delapin.
And I'm Theo Burke. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 a.m., Abe Proctor and Joe Uris host the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9 a.m. on Alternative Radio, Naomi Klein speaks on The Radical Leap. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Alan Montesillo guest hosts Stage and Studio. And at 11:30, Art Focus is off. Instead, we'll hear Making Contact featuring Jane Meyer, author of Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires, and also James Bennett, Atlantic Magazine Editor-in-Chief. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a KBOO member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
Now stay tuned for an in-depth interview with Harris Safar of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community about a recent special interfaith prayer service.